Uncover from CBC Podcasts is your source for exceptional storytelling and groundbreaking journalism. Unveil the shocking secrets of one of Canada's most prolific fashion moguls.
He far exceeds Jeffrey Epstein. He far exceeds Bill Cosby.
And dive into the unsolved murders of two Canadian billionaires.
This is a perfect storm of conspiracy theory. It's got all the ingredients, none of the answers.
With new episodes released weekly, you'll hear the very best in award-winning true crime. Listen to Uncover wherever you get your podcasts. This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Damon Fairless. On August 11th, 1973, a girl named Cindy Campbell hosted a birthday party in the rec room of 1520 Sedgwick Avenue, an apartment building in the Bronx. The entertainment for that party was her brother, Clive, better known as DJ Kool Herc.
And I told him, I said, I'm going to try something new tonight. I'm going to call it a merry-go-round.
He was working the turntables, using this new technique he had perfected where he'd switch back and forth between two copies of the same record, using two turntables. And as the story goes, hip-hop was born.
Bongo rock was still, no vocals in it, and I would go into Baby Huey, you know, the Mexican. I think we got some hit, you know, because people was like, oh, whoa. Everybody was like, yeah, I'm feeling this. Oh, yeah, you know.
Now, a genre of music isn't built in a day, but that party where Kool Herc played, think of it as the launch pad where something incredible took off. And it's the reason why hip-hop celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. What started out in the South Bronx became a best-selling, record-breaking, globally influential art form. And along the way, it was scrutinized and debated. It challenged people's ideas of the black experience, and it also shaped politics and pop culture.
A Florida jury says the rap group 2 Live Crew can't be as nasty as they want to be if they want their records sold in stores.
Gangster rap has become incredibly popular and profitable by selling lyrics about black-on-black violence to a young mainstream audience.
They are selling explicit sex and violence to younger and younger kids, and they don't seem to care about any scars they leave. They take the money and they run.
So today, we're going to talk about a few of the defining moments in the genre's 50 years with rapper, broadcaster, and hip-hop scholar Shadrack Kabongo. You might know him as Shad. Shad hosted the award-winning documentary series Hip Hop Evolution. Hey Shad, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I brought up that story of hip-hop's kind of origin story in the intro, so to speak, because as you explain in your series, that party at 1520 Sedgwick Avenue kind of gives us the context that helps us understand what hip-hop is all about. So I think it makes sense for us to start there too. So maybe you can help me understand what life was like in the South Bronx at the time, and I guess even more specifically, what was the music culture like?
Yeah, so the South Bronx at that time was the poorest neighborhood, not just in New York City, but in all of New York State. So you're talking about, you know, devastation. Burnt out buildings is very famously a characteristic of that neighborhood at that time, because the buildings and the land was so sort of depressed in terms of value that landlords would just burn down the entire building to get the insurance money.
The fire statistics for New York are staggering. New York has more fires than Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, and Philadelphia put together. And the busiest district is the South Bronx, where last year the men from Battalion 27 responded to more than 10,000 calls. On average, that's one every 45 minutes, night and day, every day of the year. Few would
challenge their claim. The city of New York was very poor at that time. So there was a lot of underfunding of schools, of after-school programs, of music programs, which is important as it relates to the invention of hip-hop, because as you said in the intro, this innovative way of using turntables, this was born out of kids not having access to instruments, to other instruments, and turning the turntable that was invented just to be a means of playing recorded music into effectively an instrument.
So let's go into the use of the turntable as an instrument, as you point out. Can you give me a sense of how it was being used in that context?
DJ Kool Herc and these kids, they were 14, 15, 16. They discovered that there were particular sections on these songs that the dancers liked to dance to, what they called breaks. So instrumental breaks, little 8-bar, 16-bar musical sections. And so they were trying to figure out a way to repeat those musical sections. And so DJ Kool Herc, Grandmaster Flash, famously just after him, came up with these innovative ways of looping these sections of the records that the dancers like to dance to that they called breaks, which is why they're called break dancers. And they figured out how to loop it seamlessly using two turntables.
I go by the name of the Grandmaster Flash from Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. And the first phase of the break mixing I will show you is called the punch phase, where I will take the foot from the four bars of Billie Jean and just fake it in as such. And at this moment, I will proceed to warm up till I get things going.
And that became a method. So that was applied to the live environment. But that's also what we hear when we hear rap music, right? Is these sections of music being looped. So that was all born from these techniques that Kool Herc and others innovated on the turntables in the 70s in the Bronx.
So it's interesting because, like you said, these are really young people. Like, these are kids. And the music that they're pulling those breaks from, can we talk about that? Because, like, at the time, disco was the thing, right? That was the dance music of the era. That was the New York City mainstream music vibe. And this is coming out of that is this other little tiny, tiny, tiny subculture at the time. So tell me a bit more about the musical kind of environment at the time.
Yeah. So that's another really important contribution of hip hop is that hip hop is fundamentally genre agnostic. The DJs played whatever made the people dance. So disco was the music of the day, and you would hear some disco at these hip hop parties, but you would also hear funk. You would also hear soul. You would also hear rock breaks. If they had, you know, some funk to them, some swing to them, you would hear Aerosmith, you would hear Billy Squire, whoever it was. Right? Tom Tom Club, an offshoot of the Talking Heads. You would hear a lot of Latin influence in the records. So there's, for example, Incredible Bongo Band. So it's really this melting pot musical culture, a bit of a response to disco, because disco was, that was for the adults. The kids in the Bronx couldn't get into the disco parties. You had to be dressed up. You had to have money. So there was some disco played at the hip hop parties because that was the music of the day, but it was much more of a melting pot that reflected that culture in the Bronx and really shaped hip hop as this genreless musical form.
Okay. So these hip hop parties, these early, you know, progenitors to hip hop parties are going on. And then it's like another 6 years before the first hip hop song, as we think of it today, is recorded. So in 1979, that's Rapper's Delight, Sugar Hill Gang. It comes out and it's huge, right? It's also 15 minutes long. It's huge in time too. So what did that do for hip hop as an art form?
Yeah, Rapper's Delight is a really interesting moment in the history of hip hop. So that's at the end of the 70s. Hip hop had been incubating in New York in that area. And other similar areas, including Toronto, actually, in the 70s. Then you have Rapper's Delight that sells, I'm not sure exactly how many copies, but I want to say at least a dozen million copies, this rap single. You rock, I said 1, 2, 3, 4, tell me 1, the mic, what are you waiting for? To the hip hop.
They hit me to the hip, hit, hip, hip, the hopper, you don't stop. Rock it to the bang, bang, the boogie, say up, jump the boogie to the rhythm of the...
Why is it 15 minutes long? Because people had no sense of how to capture what rap was in a recording. It was party music. It was something that you did for 15, 30 minutes, an hour. You know, a guy would get on the mic while a DJ like Kool Herc is playing records. So it is hilariously 15 minutes long, but it spread hip hop far, far and wide.
I mean, we're jumping ahead a little bit, but just touching on kind of another aspect of the culture that's developing. These early hip hop performers, they didn't look anything like what we consider hip hop now. And it was pretty wild. Like, it was this kind of interesting mix of, like, I don't know, punk, glam rock, and then things changed. So let's talk about who it was who really first kind of solidified that look that we still associate with hip hop.
Run DMC, when they came on the scene in the early 80s and mid 80s, were the first to dress in what we would consider maybe classic hip hop fashion. Mm. They got the street shoes on. They have Adidas on. Yeah. They have Kangol hats on. They have leather bomber jackets on.
Fresh, you like to have your fresh sneakers on. So we just leave our old ones in the store.
Fresh out the box.
New ones on and walk right out the store. That's why King of Rock, we always say, when we're on the tape, we're fresh out the box.
And what they were doing is just dressing like themselves, dressing like kids in their neighborhood. But that was such an innovation at that time, because it was strange to just dress like yourself on a stage. You're supposed to dress like a star, like you said, glam rock and all these things. You're supposed to elevate the presentation. And Run DMC really changed the game and gave hip hop its own aesthetic in terms of fashion by just dressing like people dressed on the street.
And I'm just thinking like the My Adidas, you know, video, like that, there was a big moment, right? With Lee on my leg and Adidas on my feet, and yo, now I'm just standing here shooting the gift.
Me and Adidas, my Adidas, standing on 2 feet. My Adidas. Huge moment. And you think about the excitement of communities seeing somebody really dressing like they do on a huge stage, on a platform like MTV or big stadiums around America.
Part of that era, and then moving beyond it, we've got Run DMC in the late 80s, and then moving into the early 90s, the genre is starting to flourish, right? Then people are starting to really pick this up and develop it. So you've got Run DMC, Public Enemy, NWA, Beastie Boys, Rakim, and the list goes on, Nas, we keep moving on. But what stands out about that particular era? I can't remember what you call it in the series, but we've kind of got this foundational era, this classic era. What stands out to you?
That's right. So we call that the golden era in hip hop. So from the mid 80s into the early 90s, Run DMC, they're the first hip hop old school superstars. Then you have mid 80s into the early 90s, the golden era. And it's called that because it seemed like every act that came out was an innovation. Mm-hmm. Like every act that came out was completely transforming the genre. So you have acts from DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince telling funny stories and having these really sharp MC DJ routines, to Public Enemy coming on the scene with literally an army behind them in terms of how they presented themselves.
Fatigues, yeah.
And in the fatigues and the mix of Chuck D's consciousness and Flavor Flav as the comedic foil with also a lot of consciousness as well. You have people like Queen Latifah bringing this consciousness, female energy to hip hop as well in a powerful way. But I don't want to see my kids see me getting beat down by daddy smacking mommy all around. You say I'm nothing without you, but I'm nothing with you. A man don't really love you if he hits you. Yeah. This is my notice to the tool. I'm not taking it no more. I'm not your personal whore. That's not what I'm here for. Ain't nothing good. Then you have artists like Rakim. And Rakim is like this BCAD moment in terms of lyricism. I go to Queens for Queens to get the food from Brooklyn. They pony in Manhattan and never been took it. Go uptown to the Bronx and boogie down. Go strong on the island, recoup and lay around. And actually, when we interviewed Run DMC for Hip Hop Evolution, I asked DMC, Daryl McDaniels, who's from the old school. I said, when you heard Rakim for the first time, what did you think? And he said, oh, I knew we were done. Like, that's how much of a shift each of these artists was bringing to hip hop. So that was really a time of flourishing and excitement around the music. A lot of creativity.
And you talk about almost like these quantum leaps between artists, but then you also see that kind of amplified on a grander scale when you look at like this tiny little thing that sprouted in the Bronx and it spreads locally, but then also across the country on the West Coast and later, you know, in the South, you get this development, this like massive bounds of development from region to region too. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that part of the evolution.
Hip hop is fundamentally New York culture, right? It was born in the Bronx, and we talked a little bit about the cultural influences in terms of the social situation there, in terms of the musical culture in that place. And it is very similar to other cities like Philadelphia, like Toronto at that time. So they were all kind of developing this thing we call hip hop. But then as that music was exported to some further regions, it starts to mingle with the local influences in some really interesting ways. So, you know, one example that really stands out for me is Los Angeles. We take for granted that there's hip hop in LA, but when that started to emerge and really take over hip hop, that was huge because hip hop was New York culture. The experiences and the stories that were being told in LA hip hop were shocking. You know, think about Ice-T, Boys in the Hood. It's considered one of the first gangsta rap records. And then N.W.A. after them and the kind of stories that they were telling that was reflecting uniquely L.A. gang life.
Ran in the house and grabbed my clip with the Mac-10 on the side of my hip. Bailed outside and pointed my weapon. Just as I thought, the fools kept stepping. Jumped in the foe, hit the juice on my ride. I got front and back.
And it was shocking to the mainstream. But it was even shocking within hip hop, to some extent. So, you know, that's Los Angeles. Then you have the South, you have Miami, Two Live Crew, one of the first real rap groups from the South to emerge. If you've ever been to Miami, that's a totally different culture than New York. That's a party culture, yeah. Right? It was just fun, irreverent, party music.
This is a very strange and frustrating story. To have your family member stolen, murdered, then missing.
I'm Connie Walker, and this is Missing and Murdered, Finding Cleo.
It's such a mystery, such an impossible task. Please, help us find her.
Finding Cleo. If you'd like to hear more, you can find the full season wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's talk about this shocking nature of the development, you know, as hip hop's developing, because it really comes into the mainstream and it basically, you know, it clashes with the mainstream. So as it's growing in influence, the scrutiny on it is also growing, right? And we've got this national campaign that starts up in the US in the mid 80s, targeting this shocking music, so to speak, as, you know, labeling it as obscene. And I'm thinking in particular of Tipper Gore, who's the former wife of former U.S. Vice President Al Gore. She was a huge figure in this movement.
These companies and some of these artists are engaged in cultural strip mining. They are selling explicit sex and violence to younger and younger kids, and they don't seem to care about any scars they leave. They take the money and they run. There are.
And even though all genres of music were kind of caught up in the lens of that scrutiny, hip hop was really a main target. So I'm thinking in 1990, we've got Two Live Crew's album Band in the USA comes out, and it's the first to get this parental advisory sticker.
We're too live, too black, too strong, doing the right thing and not the wrong. So listen up, y'all, to what we say. We won't be banned in the USA.
And the album before that, As Nasty As They Want to Be, you know, the cover art is them lying on a beach with like four almost naked, you know, bikini clad women there as part of this party culture you talk about. That album's the subject of a trial. Can you kind of walk me through that?
Yeah. So again, this can be hard to imagine, but that album was deemed illegal to sell. There was a record store owner that was arrested for selling that album. It was deemed illegal.
A Florida jury says the rap group Two Live Crew can't be as nasty as they want to be if they want their records sold in stores. In what's being called a landmark case, the jury convicted a record store owner on obscenity charges for selling a Two Live Crew album, an album banned by a federal judge because of its lyrics. Charles Freeman was...
Right, and it took an appeal. It took Henry Louis Gates, the famous Harvard professor, testifying to the inspirations, to the culture behind that music. It's Miami party culture. It's also a culture of comedy, black comedy records that were going around the South at the time. So it took all of that to even make it legal, literally. So that was a victory that was won by hip hop for all of music.
And we see that. We see the effect of that still, right? In terms of like artists like Megan Thee Stallion, Cardi B, you know, artists who are making overt sexuality what would have been termed then as obscene, part of their persona, part of their art, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think of Lil Nas X as a recent example as well with his Montero campaign, you know, and there's a lot of controversy around that.
That victory to number one has not come without controversy, as the video's satanic theme and homoerotic displays of affection have caused quite the reaction online and beyond.
But we would still never imagine that it would be banned outright. And wasn't that long ago that music, hip hop music, was outright banned. And so that was a victory that had to be fought and won.
Okay, just kind of switching tack a little bit. Let's also talk about the money, because hip hop becomes incredibly lucrative over time. And you can see that, like, physically with the jewelry, you know, artists wear. Bling is now a term everyone uses. Yeah. So how did money affect the evolution of the genre?
Yeah, in so many ways. So hip hop was always culture, you know, initially. Mm-hmm. And what artists aspired to be, because there wasn't a big industry, was just the best. The best, the most innovative, the most creative. And that's why we had that golden era of hip hop that we were talking about earlier with all these stylistic innovations, because there wasn't much of an industry around the music. When there was, getting into the 90s, this is becoming a very popular musical form, eventually the most popular musical form. It did shape the music. People had more commercial considerations, and it became less of a culture and more of an industry. And by that, what I mean is the aspects of the culture that were less lucrative started to fall to the wayside, or started to become marginalized, started to become more kind of fringe and less central. So you started to hear less consciousness in the mainstream music. And what you heard a lot more of in the mainstream was kind of more pop sounding, whatever was selling. I mean, that's the logic of industry, is whatever is selling, you create and sell more of that, and whatever's not selling as much kind of gets bumped to the margins. But in terms of culture, some of that stuff in the margins is really important to kind of the totality of it, to the actual culture of the thing.
I kind of want to zoom out for a second and look more broadly at the music industry. So in 2004, rock and roll turns 50. And the music industry then was in a really different spot back in the 2000s, like early 2000s. So this is before streaming. A lot of things have changed. So maybe as kind of the first line of thought here, maybe we can talk about what the industry conditions were like for rock and roll back then when it turns 50. What was the industry like?
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting comparison to make. So 2004, I would say in terms of rock music, just before that, there was quite a bit of anxiety about whether or not this is the end of rock music. So Radiohead had put out OK Computer and Kid A, and it seemed to signal that rock music was maybe done. But then you have this explosion that happened with the Strokes and some other band, trying to think, the White Stripes and artists like that, bringing some more energy back into the genre. Also, in terms of the industry, this was just post Napster. So downloading has really disrupted the traditional music industry.
Napster is enabling millions of people to get free music with just a few keystrokes at their computers. The idea is deceptively simple. It's called file sharing.
And so you have this independent movement of music that's starting to develop around that time too, that's also bringing a lot of energy. The other thing I think in terms of comparison, by that point in the history of rock music, rock had subdivided into all of these different interesting subgenres, right? You had punk rock, you have heavy metal. People were talking a lot about indie rock at that time. Hip hop, by comparison, I think, is still sort of talked about as this one uniform thing. It doesn't have the same, I guess, system of subgenres or way that we conceptualize it, even though the music really has evolved in that way. If you think about an artist like Kendrick Lamar and what he's doing creatively and conceptually versus a new younger artist like Yeet, for example, like you can hardly compare the two. What their creative sort of aspirations are so different, and yet we still talk about them like under this one umbrella of hip hop as if they have the same creative goals, you know. So that's a big difference to me that I think is not good for hip hop. I think we really need to start to think about hip hop. We need to have the proper respect for hip hop like we do for rock music in order to think about artists differently, think about these subgenres a little bit differently. And then the industry is in a very different place, right? 2004, as you said, there was no streaming. And now we're fully in the streaming era. We've been there for about a decade. And hip hop has proven to be really popular on streaming. So yeah, it's interesting to look at the two, you know, very important genres in popular music and where they were at 50 years in.
And I guess just a little further, like on those differences, and I guess I'm asking you to speculate or prognosticate in an impossible way, but I'm curious about the longevity. Like, what do these differences mean for hip hop going forward, do you think?
Well, streaming definitely is going to help the longevity of any genre, right? Because stuff can literally live. I mean, at least right now, we're imagining that it will live forever on streaming, these different songs, right? It does some interesting things to the history and the way that history is kind of archived. So the example that's coming to mind is De La Soul, who this year just finally got their music. This is a very important act in terms of hip hop, but their music wasn't on streaming because of some complicated legal issues. Their music wasn't on streaming until this year. So, you know, what that does in terms of preserving the history properly, sort of archiving, streaming presents some potential challenges. The other thing I think of in terms of longevity, so 50 years of rock and roll. Well, when rock and roll started, I don't think people were really talking in terms of, oh, this music is just going to be a fad. It's not going to be around. But that really was the conversation with hip hop for 10, 20 years, maybe, into hip hop. And so for hip hop to reach 50 years, to me feels like a greater milestone because of how much it was debated and dismissed for probably about half of its existence. It makes 50 years feel like that much more significant of a milestone. And then as I was sort of saying as well, you know, 2004, a couple years prior, they thought rock and roll was maybe dead, and hip hop seems to be thriving as much as ever, 50 years in. So that's another, to me, interesting point of comparison.
Just before, you know, we part ways here, you know, as an artist, you've talked to some incredible people. Is there a moment in these 50 years of hip hop that kind of left a big impact on you personally?
Well, one thing I was struck by working on the series was really how young artists are in hip hop and what they're able to do at such a young age. I'm thinking of Grandmaster Flash all the way at the origins. So at 13, 14 years old, he was grabbing his parents' tools and going inside of mixers and turntables to see how they work, to actually change how they work in order to make this equipment do what he wanted it to do. You know, he was 13, 14 years old. He was cutting slip mats out of felt. There weren't slip mats for turntables. That's something that you put on top of the platter between the record and the platter. He was cutting that out of felt on the floor in his parents' apartment, because he had figured out that material is the right material to allow the record to spin, but allow him to manipulate the record with his hand without damaging the record. So all these innovations coming from kids. I think about Tupac, who died, I want to say, in his mid-20s.
24, and 25, right?
The kind of music that he was making, how prolific he was, the kind of consciousness that he brought at such a young age. You know, what would he have been doing now if he was still alive? So that's one thing that has stayed with me kind of, you know, throughout my life as a fan and as someone that makes hip hop, but also working on this series. It was just reinforced for me how amazing young creativity is in this form.
I can't think of a better spot to end it than that. That's great. Shad, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, thanks.
Appreciate it. That's all for today. You can find Shad's series, Hip Hop Evolution, on Netflix. Front Burner was produced this week by Rafferty Baker, Lauren Donnelly, Shannon Higgins, Joyta Shengupta, Matt Muse, and Derek Vanderwijk. Sound design was by Mackenzie Cameron and Sam McNulty. Music by Joseph Shabison. Our senior producer is Elaine Chow. Our executive producer is Nick McCabe-Locos. And I'm Damon Fairless. Thanks for listening. We're taking a break early next week. We'll be back on Wednesday. So from all of us here at Front Burner, have a great holiday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.